Discover insights to boost your business or improve your quality of life right here on the Soar to Success podcast with your host, Pat Altvader.
I am so very excited to introduce you today to the powerfully persuasive speaker, trainer, and media personality, Leslie Gold. She was formerly referred to as the radio chick, and today she's going to share with us the power of persuasion and how to tell effective stories that will get the results that we want. Welcome to the podcast, Leslie.
Thank you, Pat. It's so great to be here.
I'm really excited for our listeners to hear about you and what you've done in your career and all the wisdom that you have around persuasion. So let's get started. Why don't you tell people what you do right now?
So as you say, I teach persuasion, and whether it be individuals or entire divisions of a corporation, I'm hired to do one of two things. Either teach people the techniques of persuasive communication and then show them how to deploy those techniques in the situations, the business situations that they face every day.
Okay.
Or I'm brought in to help with a specific critical business presentation, such as a presentation to the board or an investor group or maybe a big important sales presentation. And then I also do speaking engagements on the subject of persuasion, and a lot of those speaking engagements are in front of women's groups.
Yes. I think I saw that you have something coming up really soon, right? The end of September, maybe? What's that?
I do. I have one the end of September and one the beginning of October, both speaking engagements in front of women. The one in October is in Torrington, Connecticut, and it's something called the WOW Forum, which is a group of women entrepreneurs who come to an all-day conference, and I'm one of four featured speakers that day. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Good. So so tell us how you got started and how you came to learn all this information about persuasion.
Well, I owned a window manufacturing company at 26. Years old. First, it was 55 employees, and later it had grown to 165 employees. It was located in the murder capital of Connecticut, so it was super glamorous.
Yeah.
And I was a young girl running an organization, mostly non-English speaking men. All of my customers were construction fields as well, so they were also men. And a lot of persuasion was needed in the 10 years I ran that company. I just needed persuasion to get people to take me seriously.
Yeah.
Because I was young and a woman, right?
Yeah.
Or to listen to me at all. And then in the beginning, I had to get persuade a bank to loan me $5 million to buy the business when I wasn't worth $5,000. I had to persuade vendors to give me credit terms I needed when they were nervous about a young girl running this company.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get employees to understand my vision and then follow it. And then, of course, persuasion was needed when we pitched large projects as well. So in the end, I got a Fortune 100 company to buy my company. I got a great big company to buy my relatively speaking, rather little company after 10 years of running it.
So how did you come to decide you wanted to buy this company when you were 26 years old?
Oh boy, that's a really long story. But I had gone to Harvard Business School. I was working in corporate America. And my father had a friend. My father, I say this with as much affection as is humanly possible. My father is an old Jew, and he had a friend who's another old Jew. And he said, Leslie, my friend Saul wants to sell his business. Did they teach you anything at that school I paid for? Meaning Harvard Business School. And I said, yeah, Dad, they taught me a little about this. I can look at a balance sheet and an income statement and help your friend. And so we met on my father's patio. And I had already seen the balance sheet and income statement, and it was a very conservatively run but well-run company. Saul had started it in a garage 30 years ago, had no debt, was really, you know, a mid-sized but nicely run company. And through my analysis, I said to him, Saul, the company's worth $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, Leslie, it's only worth three, because he had started it in a garage 30 years ago, and that's how he thought of it.
Yeah.
So in arguing, I got animated and I was banging my fist on the patio table saying, Saul, even at my number, the business would pay for itself. And to make my point, I said, I would buy it at $5 million. And he said, you would? And we all went silent. And I thought about it for a moment and I said, yes, but I need terms because I had no money. And that's really how it got started. It wasn't that I had a dream to be a window manufacturer. I just saw a good opportunity. And I thought, this is really a unique opportunity that someone could take advantage of. Why not me?
Yeah, that's fantastic. So then after you sold it, what happened to you then?
So that whole experience taught me a tremendous amount about being personally persuasive, one-on-one. Mm-hmm. Then I went into talk radio. For 2 years, I was in Boston. The rest of my time, I was in New York City. New York City is the number one market, of course, mm-hmm. not for sissies. I called the show The Radio Chick Show, and my job was to deliver young men to the station. That was my charge. Mm-hmm. I was an unknown in the market, and over 15 months' time, I, along with my team, built an audience of over 1 million daily listeners, and they were a rabid, insane group of listeners who were ridiculously engaged with the show. And that experience, doing that for another 10, 12 years, taught me a lot about a different type of persuasion, the one-to-many persuasion. Mm-hmm. So back to talking about what I do or why I do it, there are others who teach what I teach. There are a lot of people who teach persuasion. But from what I have seen, a lot of them are either academics. So there are communication professors who study the subject. There's nothing wrong with that per se. Absolutely nothing wrong. But it is not direct experience. Mm-hmm. Or there are speakers who use the experience of other people. They sort of curate the experience of others and they present that in their presentations. There's nothing wrong with that either. But again, it's not direct experience. And I know in my bones that there is a huge difference between talking about something and living it. And there's a huge difference between talking about how others meet challenges or having to meet them yourself and having to meet them under the weekly pressure of payrolls or loan payments to the bank or deadline pressures or daily ratings pressures in the case of radio.
Yeah. So how did you convince the radio stations to hire you with no experience?
So, my very first radio job was in a little teeny station in Westport, Connecticut. As I was selling my window company, I thought, well, what do I want to do next? The sale of the company was a life-changing experience, and it offered me an opportunity to do something for love rather than money.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'm too ugly for TV, but I have big opinions, so how about radio? And I was still transitioning out for the new owners at the window company, so I was still going on sales calls or taking important meetings or, you know, making the transition for them as smooth as possible. And I went to a sales meeting, and wherever I went, I said to anybody, do you know anyone in radio? I said it to the guy who filled my car with gas before self-serve, by the way. I said it to my dry cleaner. Everywhere I went, do you know anyone in radio? And I happened to say it at this meeting, and the customer said, yeah, I know someone who owns WMMM in Westport, Connecticut, but they're going bankrupt. And I said, perfect,
I'll buy them.
I didn't buy them, but I said, who else would hire me except somebody with nothing to lose, right? So I went to them and I convinced them to hire me, and they put me on at night. It was I'm getting a little radio geeky with you, but a large radio station is 50,000 watts.
Okay.
This station had 1,000 watts during the day, and it powered down to 2 watts at night.
Oh.
Two.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine the strength of a 2-watt light bulb?
Like the few blocks over.
But I didn't know anything about radio. So that's when I was on.
Yeah.
And the only people who could hear me were the 13 mobile homes that lived directly under the radio's transmitter. But because they lived under the transmitter, they couldn't get any other station. So they were like my captive audience, and I would get calls. I would get calls from the same 13 people all the time, but I didn't know. And I thought I was really, really in radio. There's something to the power of delusion. I really didn't know. And so with that, the show was popular. I didn't realize it was popular with the same 13 people. And I got delusions of grandeur, and I started reaching out. I got profiled in the Connecticut Post, and I got picked up other places. And eventually with that bravado that I had, that I thought I was really in radio, I reached out to the three most important people in radio that I knew. I listened to Don Imus. I reached out to his boss. I listened to WABC in New York. I reached out to the boss there, and I listened to Howard Stern. I reached out to that boss. Mm-hmm. Circuitously, all three of them yielded something, but the one that took was Howard Stern's boss, who I sent my package to him on a Friday, and he called me on a Monday, and he said, I listened to your tape, and you're awful, but I hear genius in you. And if you want, I'll help you. Wow. And that's how I really got started.
Yeah, that is amazing. What a wonderful story. So you left radio then to start to spread the word about persuasion within yes. companies then and yes. to women entrepreneurs, et cetera.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I've been doing that now for about 2-3 years.
Okay, great. So tell me a little bit about, I was reading a little bit about the things that you teach, storytelling, resonating, analogies, presence, countenance, those sort of things. So tell us a little bit how someone who's a small business owner could benefit by knowing this information.
People that want to be persuasive often rely on the wrong methods, the wrong techniques, especially business people who are immersed in numbers mm-hmm. all day long. I feel like the data itself can be compelling and persuasive. When you say 83% of people benefited from my product, mm-hmm. you think that's persuasive.
Yeah.
Data is good. Data, there's a place for data, but if you really want someone to make a decision, you have to tap into them emotionally. And there's no better way to do that than with storytelling. The best way to marry an idea with an emotion is through storytelling. Even if I'll use an example from a consulting firm that I worked with. I was brought in to a consulting firm, and they consulted with consumer goods companies. And when I looked around the room as I was doing my speech, there were a lot of very young faces in the audience mm-hmm. That worked for them. Smart kids, all smart, all from great schools, but young. And I put myself in their shoes and I thought, okay, so these 20-something-year-old kids have to go in a room with grizzled veterans of their industries and convince them they know what they're doing, mm-hmm. right? That's a hard position to be in. I was in that position briefly. I felt like a fraud at yeah. the time. Uh-huh. So we talked about how, certainly with a story, you're not going to be able to convince people of your wealth of experience because you don't have it. But what you can do is this. You can buy goodwill. So let's say you're a young consultant and you're speaking to consumer goods executives who are thinking about making a foray into the popcorn market. Mm-hmm. And you're doing a portion of the presentation. You can do a 40-second story, buy yourself a whole load of goodwill. And here's how I might postulate it would go. Hey, before we begin, I just want to say that I was really excited that Jill assigned me to this project because I'm really interested in the popcorn market. You know, I grew up in a middle-class family. My mom was a nurse and my father was a janitor. We didn't have a lot of money, but we were a happy family. And my parents would have to scrimp and save for everything. But once a week, we would rent a movie from Blockbuster back in the day, and my mother would make a big bowl of popcorn, and the three kids would sit at the foot of the couch, and my parents would sit on the couch, and we would all dig into that bowl of popcorn and watch the movie. And it's one of the most heartwarming memories of my family that I have. Movie night was a big deal for us. So as a result, popcorn means fun, and it means family to me. And also, as a result, I'm very picky about my popcorn. So it was very exciting for me to be able to delve into this market for you. You didn't say anything like, I'm the world's greatest popcorn expert. I've been dealing in popcorn, you know, trading in popcorn my whole life. You didn't say anything like that. All you did was say, here's why I, with a story, here's why I'm a great match for your project. Mm-hmm. And with that 40-second story, which would be refined, I was doing it off the top of my head, would be refined a little better, you buy yourself some goodwill.
Yeah.
And you also buy some patience from a grizzled group of executives who might have been very quick to dismiss you because you're 20-something years old making a presentation, but now they'll sit back and say, maybe this person has something to offer. I'm going to listen to it for a few minutes.
Yeah. And so when you talk about that, that applies to a lot of our clients who are video creators who are not necessarily selling in their videos, but they want to establish that what you're calling goodwill, or we might call it resonating with the audience. So what are the elements of a good story that they should think about when they're going to craft it into their messaging, whether it be a video or a blog or any other way of content that they're putting out for their audience?
So there's two essential elements in my view for a story. One, it has to have an emotional arc. You have to start somewhere and finish somewhere with an emotion tied in. And it has to have a human being in it, at least one human being to which the listener can relate. Uh-huh. Right? Without a human being, it's not a story. Then there needs to be a moral. In the old days, they called it the moral to the story. Today, they call it the controlling idea. It's the takeaway. It's the lesson you want your audience to walk away with. And that moral of the story has to be stated by you. You can't allow the audience to draw their own conclusion as to what the moral of the story is. Because you can tell a story, and often there can be two or three perfectly plausible takeaways. Mm-hmm. So you need to state what it is so it's clear. And then there's certain descriptive techniques you can use to build a story. There's both a narrative way of talking and a scenic way of talking. These are all things that I teach. I won't go into them now. And then at the end, you take a scalpel to it and make sure that you're not throwing in, women do this a lot, throw in a lot of extraneous detail that they think is needed, but it really isn't to make their point. Yeah. And then you have a story.
Yes. And so explain the emotional arc a little bit more. Like, what does that mean exactly?
Can I demonstrate it for you as well?
Yeah. So the emotional arc, that story that you told about the popcorn.
Right.
So the emotional arc is the family gathering for the
emotional arc. Yes. Is that the emotional arc is the warm feeling of family that you've created in the story, in the picture that you've told, right? Mm-hmm. So we didn't have a lot of money. We were sad family, but you know, we weren't all that sad because we had movie night and we loved each other. There's a very short emotional arc that we traveled, right? Mm-hmm. So at first it seemed like it was going to be a story about struggle, and then it turned out to be a story about happy popcorn eating.
Yes.
So that the emotional arc, if you really want it to work, it's not just tying in an emotion, but it's tying in an emotional journey, as short as you need, right? You need to start one place and finish, emotionally speaking, with another.
Okay.
I'll give another example. you know, we talk about stories in your clients, Pat, and how they have to establish credibility. It brought to mind a client that I work with. He was an insurance guy selling insurance. I was brought into insurance company and I thought this is going to be unbelievably tedious because what is less exciting about insurance? Yeah. I couldn't think of too many things, but I was wrong. It was not
good thing.
Right. We found a story for every agent that I worked with. I was working with the company and their top agents. But the one that made me, you triggered for me was this. I was working with an agent, couldn't find a story, kept wanting to talk about coverage and how important coverage is. And I had my head in my hands about coverage is not emotional. You know, coverage is a terrible word. It's boring. Please don't build your story around that. So we broke for lunch. And in lunch, he was telling me this story, how he had a customer. He was the grandson of somebody who fought in World War II. His grandpa fought in World War II. He was getting insurance, and he said to the insurance agent, hey, I have these love letters that my grandpa wrote my grandma when he was away, you know, fighting the Nazis in World War II. Can I insure them? And the insurance agent said, hey, you know what? I don't really know what kind of value to put on them. They're not valuable to anybody but you. Mm-hmm. You couldn't replace them no matter how much money you got. And they don't have any value to anyone else. You'd really be wasting your money. So just keep them safe and make sure you keep them safe and treasure them and don't insure them because money won't make you whole if you lose them. Okay. Fast forward now, Hurricane Sandy is bearing down on the East Coast, and the agent is doing his good agent thing. He's calling all his customers, and he's saying, hey, if you have any damage, this is the number to call. Here's how you reach me. Here's my cell phone number, blah, blah, blah. He calls his client, the grandson, who's frantically packing up his car, putting his kids and his pets and his computer in the car to evacuate, and he makes his call, and he says, hey, what about your grandpa's letters? Oh my God, says the grandson, thank you so much. I don't know what happened, but presumably he ran back in, he grabbed the letters and he evacuated. I said to the insurance agent, that's your story. Mm-hmm. And he said, but it has nothing to do with coverage. I said, but it's got everything to do with character.
Yeah.
It's your character story. And a character story is one of the most powerful stories that you can tell, something that reveals an element of your character to people. So in his case, I thought that's a guy I would love to do business with, a guy that cared about me enough to remember my letters, even though it had nothing to do with the business that we were doing together. And maybe there is something in there for your clients to talk about a story that reveals their character some way when they present their stories on video.
Yeah. Great. That's perfect. Perfect. So earlier you mentioned that you had some presentations coming up for women's groups. So do you make a different presentation when you're speaking to those types of groups versus when you're brought into a company?
I do, actually. I love speaking in front of groups of women, whether it's a women's organization or a networking group. Communicating while female can bring with it some very special challenges. Women are more likely than men to speak in a way that perhaps unfairly undermines their credibility. Mm-hmm. And some of the fixes, Pat, are kind of simple. When I speak in front of women's groups, I do this meaty section I call communicating while female. And more than one woman has told me that it's life-changing. I think that's an overstatement. But I do think that I teach things that can really make a difference, whether it be tone or pacing, your physicality, your physical presence, avoiding, women tend to use more watery words than men. A lot of women, I used to do this, I don't do it anymore, do what I call reflexive apologizing. For instance, sorry to bother you, instead of may I have a moment of your time. Mm-hmm. Those are, you know, those two things say the same thing and feel very different.
Yes.
When storytelling, when women storytell and they're going to storytell to a group of men or mostly men, they need to shorten their stories, and women can also give in to nerves too early. They give up too early. They start strong and then they get some resistance and they stay in the game and they get a little more resistance and they melt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And so we talk about nerves and we talk about not giving up so much and so on. And I teach a lot of these. A lot of these fixes are very simple to do about your physicality or choosing the right words, avoiding watery words, such as, I just want to say, don't say that. Or I feel like this is a bad idea. Don't say that. You say.
I know they discount what they're about to say.
Right.
So you're like, well, why are you saying it then?
Right. So I'd love to speak to women because I think we're sort of socially conditioned to do this stuff. We don't even realize we're doing it. But small changes can have a big effect in their lives.
One thing that I notice about women that really irritates me is that they tend to inflect up at the end of a sentence, like they're asking for approval instead of making their statement and inflecting down.
I think it's more of a generational thing. Younger generations younger than I do that, where they end a declarative statement as if it was a question.
Yeah.
Right. They don't even realize it. It's called upspeak. Yeah. But yeah. It's pretty prevalent now.
Great. Well, thanks. So how did you come to know that storytelling was so powerful?
So I mentioned I owned a window manufacturing company and then I sold it. And after the sale, I went into talk radio. I did 2 years in Boston and then I did the rest in New York. And I couldn't believe my luck getting a job in New York after such a short time. It's a number one market. And the station said my job was to deliver young men to the station, men age 18 to 34. So I named the show the Radio Chick Show. And with my on-air sidekick and producer, we invented, they call them bits in the business, Pat, signature bits that we felt would appeal to this audience of young men. And they were bits like 20 questions with a hooker, the vaginal psychic, and the wheel of puke. So now before you judge, it was a different time, right? It was the late 90s. It was before Janet Jackson had exposed herself at the Super Bowl, which honestly changed broadcasting.
Wow.
Just to place it in time, there was email, but there was no social media of any consequence yet. MySpace hadn't even been invented yet.
Okay.
And we were just light years away from hashtag me too or hashtag time's up.
Yeah.
So these outrageous bits, as we call them in the business, were, in my mind, the pillars of the show. In between these things, I would tell stories or I would analyze the news or we would discuss our lives. And the show began to get traction. We began to rise up in the ratings quarter by quarter. First quarter, we were 21st, the next 17th. Then we were 12th. The next quarter, we were 9th, and then we were 5th. 5th in the market, and I felt incredible. Right? I had over 1 million listeners, and listeners were doing insane things in homage to the show, like hanging 150-foot banners off the Triborough Bridge and getting arrested for it. So the antics seemed to be working. And I'd walk home from work because I'd have so much excitement in me, I'd have to burn it off somehow. And I think to myself, I can't believe someone paid, especially coming from the murder capital of Connecticut, making windows. Mm-hmm. I can't believe someone pays me to do this job. I would pay them to let me do it. So when my show reached 5th in the ratings, my boss marched a bottle of champagne into the studio, all smiles, as a congratulation. A short 3 months later, 2 days before we were about to reach 3rd in the ratings, he fired me.
What?
And I did not see that coming.
Yeah.
It wasn't from an incident. I had not been disciplined for any reason. He told me that they were bringing in a team from his old station in Washington, D.C., who, in his judgment, would be a better fit for the station. And that was it. I was fired. And so was my team. Stunned would be an understatement. The worst part about it for me was it totally gutted everything I thought I knew about myself. I mean, I wasn't the kind of person people fired. I was the kind of person people fought to keep.
Yeah.
So I had the only rational response possible. I sat in the dark and ate Haagen-Dazs every day for 2 weeks. I never got dressed. I wore the same pussycat doll sweatpants every day. I really had to after all that Haagen-Dazs. I was still under contract, so I was still getting paid for a while to sit home and lick my wounds, but that was no solace to me, none. So in this pig out period, one of the listeners reached out to me. Her nickname from the show was Joyce from Under the Console. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. Remember, it was a different time.
Yeah.
So Joyce informed me that she was going to organize a letter writing campaign to CBS Radio, my employer, to object to my firing. And I remember very clearly thinking, oh, that's so cute, and I'll never work. And I stuck my spoon back into the Haagen-Dazs. But even though it was the early days of the internet, Joyce somehow organized a rather consequential letter writing campaign. And all the letters were addressed to Mel Karmazin, who was the head of CBS Radio. I had not met Mel Karmazin. He was far too many levels above me. Mm-hmm. But when the 10,000th letter crossed the threshold of his office, the 10,000th physical envelope, from 10,000 different people. I don't know how Joyce did this. He called the program, Mel Karmazin called the program director at my station and said, you fired her at third and we're still paying her? Bring her back. So I and my team were brought back. Wow. I won't tell you it wasn't awkward. It was like a mob hit gone bad, right? Yeah. We were working for a guy we knew didn't want us there.
Yeah.
But we were back on the air, and the listeners, of course, made me feel loved. And when I opened, here's the lesson. When I opened the mic for the first time on that first show back, I asked them, all of you who wrote a letter, the 10,000 or so of you who bothered, what made you want to bring us back? And I expected to hear how funny those outrageous bits were, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I love the flaming stripper barbecue, right, that you did. But instead, I heard Chick, which is what they call me, short for Radio Chick. Chick, the day you told the story about how you had to put your dog to sleep, I sat in my car and I cried like a baby. Mm. Or Chick, when you told your story about how your father desperately was trying to set you up with his podiatrist son, I laughed so hard I spilled coffee down my shirt. It was the storytelling. That's what bound my listeners to me. I didn't even know what my own show was built on. I thought it was built on the wheel of puke. It wasn't. It was the storytelling that bound my listeners to me. That's why they felt so connected and so invested in the show. So first, storytelling literally saved my career.
Yeah.
But moreover, truly, that was the day I realized what a powerful tool this storytelling stuff could be and how you can move an audience of one or 1 million with the right story.
Yeah.
Now, every one of my stories weren't so great at that time. Some of them worked and some didn't. But I started to analyze why certain stories worked on the air and certain didn't. I needed to know first so I could replicate it.
Yeah.
And then today I know, and today I can teach it.
Teach it. Yeah. Wow. That is so amazing. I'm glad that you shared that with us, because I think it's a really important point for people to know that sometimes you're doing something and you don't even realize what the thing is that you're doing that works, for one, and two, the power of storytelling. That was really, really fantastic.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you let me tell the story.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you're doing the women's presentations and that you also like to speak to companies and that you have clients that are companies that bring you in. So tell us who your ideal client is and what sort of engagements are you looking for with those clients?
Well, persuasion, of course, is in every facet of business, right? Persuasion is necessary. You need to convince your customer to buy your product. You need to convince a investor to put money into you. You need to convince your clients to go along with your plan. You need to convince your stockholders to buy your stock, or at least not sell it, whatever it might be. So there's a wide group of people that I can speak to. Anybody that really needs to sell an idea, either internally or externally, mm-hmm. can benefit from the presentation. But I tend to be brought into a lot of industries that are data driven, and that's where I can make the biggest difference. So I get called into hedge funds, financial service industries, the insurance industry, as I mentioned. I was brought into a company that sells cases for musical instruments and electronic instruments. Anywhere that people are really feel they're in sort of a dry, unsexy, or data-driven business, that's where I can make the biggest impact.
Because you can find their stories within.
Yes, they can't make those connections. I can make them for them. Yeah. And then, of course, I love to speak in front of women's groups, as I mentioned, women's networking groups, women entrepreneurial groups, you know, women's business groups, anything like that. That's also a sweet spot for me.
Yeah. Excellent. Great. Well, tell us how our audience can get in touch with you.
LeslieGoldSpeaker.com is the best way. LeslieGoldSpeaker.com.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for being on the call with me today. I really totally loved it. It was very much fun for me to chat with you today. So thanks for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure, Pat. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, great. Bye-bye. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Soar to Success podcast. For more insights into growing your business or improving your quality of life, visit SoarToSuccessMagazine.com and subscribe to the Soar to Success podcast on iTunes.